If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. What should you do with a medieval mule? Well, if you carry on listening, you're about to find out. Dr. Catherine Smithies is a medievalist based at the University of Melbourne in Australia. She's just written a book about donkeys in the Middle Ages, which was a topic that our content director and resident medieval animal enthusiast, Dave Musgrove, leapt at the chance of recording a podcast about.
So, Catherine, firstly, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why have you written a book about the medieval ass?
Well, I mean, to me, it's such a fascinating, fabulous and complex creature. It's got so much meaning and significance and symbology in the medieval period that I felt it deserved to be considered in its singularity in a standalone book. There are books that consider animals in medieval society, but there's nothing that focuses on the ass alone. So that's really why. And then on top of that, I've always really had a soft spot for donkeys, stems from my childhood. I think like everybody else, donkey rides on the beach, donkey stories. I really liked the Ladybird book, Ned the Lonely Donkey. And then, of course, you know, fast forward several decades, I'm a medieval historian. I've got an interest in animals in medieval literature. So when I was offered this opportunity to write the book, I had to say yes.
I'm not familiar with the book Ned the Lonely Donkey. That sounds like a corker.
It's quite old. And it was at my grandma's. I used to read it every Sunday on those weekly visits. But it made it into the last chapter.
So you've written this book, and it's an introductory book. It's suitable for anyone who's interested in medieval history, and it's a very enjoyable read. I've had a read of it. Let's just start off with just a few terms, though. We've talked about ass and donkey. Can we just sort that out? So is the ass the same as a donkey? What's a mule, and when was this animal actually domesticated? So a few questions in one there, but perhaps you could just give us the basics.
Yep, sure. So ass and donkey, let's start with that. Yes, an ass is a donkey. They are exactly the same animal. Today, obviously, in this English-speaking world, we prefer the term donkey, and that's because in the 18th century, there were variations in the pronunciation of the letter A. So it was either a long or short, so we had ass and arse, depending on regional variations. And then, of course, to avoid any embarrassment of using a word in polite company that sounded like bottom, the word donkey was adopted. But in the medieval world, the ass was known by its Latin name, asinus, hence ass. As for a mule, well, that's the result of crossbreeding between a female horse and a male donkey. And what we see in the mule is it's got that hybrid vigour and it takes the best from both worlds. So it's got the endurance of the donkey, but it requires less food than a horse. And we know that the medieval world certainly bred mules, but they really come into their own in the new world. So a little bit after the medieval period. The donkey was first domesticated about 6,000 years ago in the Middle East. And that possibly came about due to water or food shortages that brought the donkey into closer contact with humans than had previously happened. So, you know, man and donkey have been around together for a long, long time.
So, but in terms of nomenclature, when we talk about the Middle Ages, it's more correct to talk about the ass and the donkey. That's how they that's the right wording. Okay, we should probably interchange a bit in this discussion, I guess. But
yes,
let's bear that in mind. And then another question. This is a creature that you bring up in your book, the Onno Centaur. What exactly is an Onno Centaur?
Okay, well, an Onno Centaur is a mythical, fantastical hybrid that's half man, half beast. Usually it's described as having the head of a man and the body of an ass. It could be the other way around. It could even be other animals as well. I think its mythical origins probably stem from a time when a group of people who had not yet got to the stage of riding equids, horses or donkeys, actually saw people riding these animals from afar. And so it looks like man and horse are one and the same creature. But in the Middle Ages, the Onno Centaur becomes a metaphor for men ruled by their animal passions and asininity, not their rational brains. So it becomes a symbol of male lust. So the creature's monstrous bestial half represents man's animal nature, but its upper human half was its rational half.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the uses of this animal in medieval Europe. So you mentioned there that the creature was domesticated a long time before the Middle Ages in the Middle East. But can you tell us how widespread the animal was in medieval Europe as a domesticated animal and what role it performed in society and economy? And I'm just going to mention a little quote in your blurb from the book, which says something like it was the white van of the Middle Ages, which is quite a nice phrase. So,
okay, so dispersal of the animal, when we're talking about how widespread it is, there's a line, there's this geographical marker that delineates the spread of the donkey in medieval Europe, and that is the 50 degree latitude, and that's roughly it follows the line of the English Channel, if you think. I mean, I know the English Channel isn't sort of straight, but roughly speaking. And what we find is that on the continent of Europe, let's say from France, southern Germany downwards, the donkey is widespread. But above that line, if we're talking the British Isles, Scandinavia, there's some evidence for the donkey, but it's minimal. And in the few cases I've come across, the location has been at major trading posts. So it suggests in those instances that the beast was maybe in transit or it was being used as a pack animal. Essentially, it's too cold above 50 degrees latitude for the donkey to thrive. And it makes perfect sense because when you think about where the ass comes from, Africa in the Middle East, I mean, it's really suited to a hot, dry climate.
What were the uses that these animals were put to below that line?
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially, I think the donkey or the ass is basically a pack animal. It's known for its sturdiness and its sure-footedness, so it's the ideal animal to carry people and loads across the Alps along major trading routes. It will carry loads to local markets, to regional fairs. The donkey would also turn grinding stones for milling. And we've got images of donkeys doing these two activities in some of the bestiaries, which are books of beasts. There's some evidence that in some places the donkey might have pulled a plough, but this seems to be quite early in the medieval period and only in certain places. Usually it seems to be teams of oxen that pulled the plough rather than the donkey. Other things, we see priests riding asses. It's a sign of their humbleness that taps into the ass's religious associations. And it's a valuable animal. I couldn't find any firm evidence for the cost of a donkey, you know, how much they were bought and sold for, but there is other evidence that points to their value. One of those is the Peace of God Treaty from 989, which was an attempt by the church to curb secular violence. And this treaty clearly states that anyone who steals an ass from the poor will be excommunicated. So it's a severe penalty. So it sort of points to the idea that the ass is it's a valuable creature. It's essential for people's well-beings. And we've also got people who are leaving, writing their last will and testament and leaving the ass to their local church or abbey. So, you know, that can be seen as a way of ensuring salvation. You know, if I give you my ass, will you pray for me when I'm dead and help me get to heaven? But it also reveals that the ass has got some monetary worth as well.
There is a bit of a taboo about eating equine animals in large parts of Europe. Were asses eaten by anybody?
Yes, they were. If I start with the taboo, like you said, there were decrees against that. But they're quite early on in the piece in the 700s. And I think that's to bring newly Christianized areas into line with Christian traditions of not eating horse meat. We know that some societies in medieval Europe did eat donkey meat, and that it was considered a delicacy. But these are really very localized and they really are the minority. The only other time people ate their donkeys were when times were particularly dire. Hildegard of Bingen, who's a 12th century Benedictine nun, she's a mystic and an abbess. My favourite quote from her is that the donkey flesh was fetid from its stupidity. I mean, clearly she's not holding back there and doesn't think much of eating donkey meat. But like I said, in desperate times, people would eat their donkeys. And it's well recorded in, for example, the accounts from the First Crusade. The chronicles tell us that food was in such short supply, especially during the siege of Antioch, that the crusaders resorted to eating the horses and then the donkeys. In fact, basically anything they could lay their hands on. And that prices for an ass went through the roof, as you can imagine.
And just on the Crusades, were donkeys important in the Crusader movements of people and the stuff they were having to carry? Do we know much about how important they were in the baggage trains going to the Middle East?
It's interesting because donkeys rarely get mentioned. They're not considered that important to be mentioned in the chronicles of the Crusades because I think it was just part and parcel that they would be used. There was nothing exceptional about them. It becomes exceptional when the Crusaders start eating them because times, are, you know, they're dying of everyone's dying of starvation. So, yeah, there are images of donkeys in war situations in the medieval manuscripts, but they're not really mentioned in writing as such.
And presumably never used in a conflict situation, never used as a ridden into battle or anything like that. They wouldn't be appropriate for that sort of thing.
I've not read anything that says that that's what they did. We know that some of the noblemen were reduced to riding the ass. And again, that's seen as being exceptional. You know, it's such a downturn in a nobleman's, you know, sign of prosperity. But whether they actually rode into battle or not, it's not really mentioned.
Okay. And were there any other uses of a dead donkey, i.e. were their skins used for anything, or were they used for any medicinal purposes, any parts of their bodies used for that?
So were the skins used for anything? The short answer is yes. Exactly what for, I'm not sure. I mean, there is archaeological evidence in parts of France for the existence of tanneries, and that those tanneries were skinning ass hides. And we also know that Albert the Great, or Albertus Magnus, he was a 13th century Dominican theologian and eventual saint. It tells us that he wore shoes made from donkey leather and that the leather was particularly tough. So I think donkey leather is being used just as any other leather is. It's not for anything in particular, and it doesn't really make it to the records in any great detail. Medicinally, we'll go back to Albert the Great again. He had quite a bit to say on this. I think the example in the book is a recipe to get rid of vermin in a house. And he recommends that if you use the burnt lungs of an ass to smoke out the house, that will get rid of the vermin. I mean, in reality, it'd probably smoke everybody out of the house. It would be unbearable. But I think I didn't put this in the book, but interestingly, Albert offers beauty treatments as well. So there's one for a medieval perm. So if you want some curly hair, this is what you need to do. You anoint your straight hair with the poo of a wild ass, the dung of a wild ass, and you must grind it up with some bile of oxen. I mean, I don't know about curly hair. It's enough to make your hair stand on end. It might even make it fall out. And so obviously those remedies are a bit dubious, to say the least. But Thomas of Canterbury, who's Albert's student, and then later on he's a colleague of Albert, does have one suggestion, and this still actually has resonance today. And he said that donkey milk was good for soothing toothache, whereas today we recommend that if you lose a tooth, you should put it in some milk as soon as possible. So they were on the right lines.
Right. So I'm assuming you've never tried the donkey dung perming method.
No, even in lockdown, where we are not allowed to go to the hairdresser, I have not resorted to Albert's techniques.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It tells us that the ass was an important beast for understanding and attaining salvation, but equally the ass was essential for people's well-being and their livelihoods. You know, most people knew about the ass from this nature or religious perspective, and that its many attributes become useful metaphors for tools and learning.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So there's lots of uses for the ass in medieval society then. So we talked through what they were used for in life and death. And that's all very interesting. But your book focuses, it covers that, but it focuses much more on the place of the ass in literature, religion, and academia. And this is where I think it gets really interesting. So I just wanted to talk about that for a bit. But before we get into that, we ought to discuss how animals generally were viewed in the Middle Ages and how far and why they were anthropomorphized. It's a difficult word to say, I always get it wrong, but I think that's right. So basically giving animals some sort of human characteristics. So can you shed any light on that before we move into this discussion?
Yes. I mean, medieval society was interested in animals, and particularly the relationship between humans and animals. I mean, obviously in the fables, we see that they are anthropomorphized, and that animals take on human attributes, and that's done in a didactic sense, so that these animals are behaving like humans, and in the fables they're meant to teach humans particular behaviours. So didactic is just another word for teaching or instructional. I mean, from my perspective as a scholar, I'm very interested in the way medieval literature works in a didactic sense. So when I look at animals, I'm always looking at that. And you see in the medieval world, it comes through really strongly that animals, even if they're not anthropomorphized and don't take on human attributes, it might be there in a metaphor or an analogy in that way.
And am I right in thinking you're quite an expert in fables and their place in medieval society?
I'm more an expert on the fablio, which are not fables at all.
What's the difference? Short.
So the fablio is a genre of French medieval literature that date from about the 13th century. They're quite ribald in their nature. And only a few of them actually have animals in them. But there is some scholarship that says they're like an offshoot from the fables, or that they've been influenced by the fables. And a few of them, you can certainly see a relationship between the two. And for me, I think that relationship comes in this, the way the fables can be understood as a didactic literature, trying to teach people the correct way to behave in the same way that the fables do. But they use humans and not animals.
And so the fable, just let's focus on the fables just for a second. So would I be right thinking the fables are basically born out of Aesop, and then they come, so a classical scholar, and then they come into medieval Europe, and they're quite widespread as and used as a moralistic and teaching aid across medieval Europe? Is that a reasonable statement?
That's excellent. That's an excellent synopsis of the fables.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about medieval understanding of animals. Let's talk specifically about the ass then. So what attributes were assigned to the ass in the Middle Ages and by whom?
Okay, so, well, the ass is associated with a paradoxical range of attributes. It's quite a contrarian beast, if you like. So in its natural world environment, we see attributes such as stubborn, but also steadfast. And these come from the classical world, and then they're carried through into the Middle Ages. And so writers such as Aristotle and Pliny the Elder talk about the ass being a stubborn but steadfast beast, and then those ideas are perpetuated and carried on in the Middle Ages. It has religious attributes, and by this obviously I mean Christian. So the ass is associated with humility, with patience, with faithfulness. But then paradoxically, the ass can also be a figure for the sinner. And obviously these ideas come from Christian writers, but I couldn't actually name anyone specifically. There's a range of influences and contexts. So obviously we've got the Bible, we've got the early church fathers, we've got the bestiary authors, and so on. There's no one single influence. And I would say that these natural and Christian world attributes become the basis for how medieval people understood the ass. And then those attributes get used in other spheres of medieval culture, such as the academic world and the world of literature and also art.
So focusing on the religious side of things for a second then. So you delineated those attributes just then. So where was the ass talked about in a religious context? Was it discussed in churches? Was it used as a teaching aid for, you know, to explain to the layman how they ought to behave?
Yeah, that's one way that it was done. I mean, obviously there's lots of ways, and the Bible is the seminal Christian text, and we see the donkey featuring in both the Old and New Testaments. But probably one of the most influential examples is that of the association of the donkey with Christ's life and the story of Christ, because obviously it carries a pregnant Mary to Jerusalem. The ass is present at the Nativity. It carries the Holy Family to safety to escape the massacre of the innocents. And then it carries an adult Christ into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. And its role in those events is essentially as the bearer of salvation. It carries Christ, who, you know, represents our salvation, and it becomes known for its humble and patient nature. So the ass becomes an exemplar of the good Christian. If we take that a bit further, when Christ has his disciples fetch the donkey to ride into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, he specifically asks for a donkey and an unbroken one. And then that symbology is that the donkey willingly submits to Christ's authority, just as good Christians submit to God. So it's one way in which the ass teaches Christians, you know, how to behave and understand the story of Christ.
So the donkey's used as a kind of a moral aid for Christian values in some ways. What about in the scholastic world then? In what way was it used as a teaching aid there?
If we just go back a few steps, what we see in the 12th and 13th century is a rise in cathedral schools and the start of the medieval universities. So formalised education really takes off at this time. And then what we see is that this idea of reason, or the concept of reason, becomes central to intellectual thought in Western medieval Europe. And so we've got all sorts of debates going on about rationality. On top of that, we've got debates about the difference between humans and animals. Is there even a difference? And then, of course, from the encyclopedic tradition, the ass is the most irrational of all the beasts. So it becomes a really useful foil for debates on rationality. If you're studying reason and rationality, well, you know, you've got this really nice alternative in the donkey, because it's the most irrational of all the beasts.
And why is that? Why is it personified as so irrational?
I think because it's stubborn, and it's not a fair attribute in a way to call the donkey stubborn, because actually it's quite cautious. But medieval people and the classical world didn't really see the donkey that way. I mean, if the donkey didn't want to walk across a slatted bridge because it felt that it was unsafe because it could see the movement of the water underneath, then it wouldn't. And it would be virtually impossible to get the donkey to cross. So it builds up this stubborn reputation, which then sort of transgresses to stupidity, if you like. And so it becomes this irrational beast.
I've got personal experience of that, actually. I went donkey trekking in the Pyrenees, and it was an excellent donkey, but we got to a little river, and the donkeys don't like crossing water, I think. Yeah. And it would not go across. So I suppose, you know, that would be a problem in the Middle Ages, because there would have been a lot of stretches of water you would need to cross.
I've seen a video where a man actually taught his donkey to cross a bridge that had running water underneath, And he was trying to show how clever the donkey was because he took it back a year later and the donkey crossed it without any issues at all. So, you know, I think it just shows how clever the donkey actually is. It's not a stupid animal at all.
Yeah. So were donkeys sort of singled out in this period for this sort of treatment? I mean, presumably other animals were also used in as teaching aids as well with other similar characteristics or attributes assigned to them.
Yes, but it really is the donkey that's the irrational, stupid beast. It's par excellence, if you like. It's particularly in this scholastic world, it's used over and over again. It's used as personal slights. So medieval scholars, when they're trying to debate their opponents and put them down, they'll call them an ass. You know, you're an ass. No, you're an ass. And so on. It's an interesting attribute, really.
Now, there's one nice little story in your book, which I'd just like you to tell us a bit more about, which is why might someone show an ass playing a lyre?
OK, well, why indeed? Obviously, because the ass is too stupid to know not to, or that it physically can't play a lyre. I mean, it is an absurd image. Seriously, though, I'd say that this why might an ass play a lyre is still open to debate. But in my book, I speak about two points of view as to why this might happen. The first applies to Boethius's famous quote in the Consolations of Philosophy, in which a character called Lady Philosophy asks the author if her words have penetrated his mind or is he as dull as the ass to the sound of the lyre. And what it's doing is highlighting that mental process whereby comprehension and understanding were not abilities that everyone was capable of. So not everyone's clever enough to understand everything that they see and read. And then that follows through into sculptures of asses playing lyres that occur in many medieval churches. This idea of understanding or an inability to understand, because it's then applied to the illiterate or unlearned Christian who faithfully believed but couldn't articulate all those, you know, high, divinely revealed truths of Christian faith. So the purpose of the sculpture was to remind churchgoers that the truly faithful were welcome in God's house. And quite often these sculptures of the ass playing a lyre are actually situated above doorways in the church. So as you walked through the doorway, if you looked up, you'd see this image, and it's just there as a reminder. The second way to understand the lyre playing ass comes from the Greek fabler Phaedrus and his fable, The Ass and the Lyre. This fable tells of an ass who finds a lyre and tries to play it, but obviously he can't. He doesn't have those human capabilities. He doesn't have the dexterous fingers. He just has these really clumsy hooves. And the cautioning moral says, you know, it challenges. The moral cautions against those who challenge the inherent nature. And inherent nature is something that concerned medieval society quite a bit. Or in another way, people trying to be something that they're not. So social climbers were often censured. Medieval society is really conservative and it doesn't like change. So if you're born a peasant, you must stay a peasant. And that's the bottom line for many fables. In the scholastic environment, this lyre-playing ass is projected onto students who are too dumb to learn, and then it's also applied to their teachers for trying to teach those who are incapable of learning. So the lyre-playing ass is representative of someone who's trying to be or do something that they're not suited to.
So depths of meaning there in that one image. It's very interesting. But one of the aspects there that you sort of alluded to is perhaps a slightly comedic side there to the donkey trying to play a musical instrument that it's clearly not physically capable of doing. And that moves us into the realm of literature a little bit, where the ass is employed in some ways in a comedic fashion. So tell us about that.
Well, I'd say the ass has always been a figure of fun. You know, we see it in the ancient Greek fables and, you know, it really doesn't come off well there. I mean, the ass that wears the lion's coat and then brays rather than roars, I mean, it's laughed at by all the other animals. So instead of being feared, which is the boast of the ass, it just becomes this figure of ridicule. As for why, I mean, I don't know really. I mean, if pushed, I'd say that the ass lends itself to being a figure of fun because of its ancient reputation as this senseless, stubborn and irrational beast that gets perpetuated. You know, and it's not just in the Middle Ages, it goes beyond. I mean, if you think about Shakespeare's Bottom from Midsummer Night's Dream, I mean, that's a figure of fun. We've got Sancho and his ass in Don Quixote. And then there's more modern donkeys, which are figures of fun as well. We've got the pessimistic Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. And then, of course, the voluble donkey in Shrek. I mean, these are all memorable donkeys that we've got some sort of attachment to, and we know them for the humour.
And what about the ass's use in political satire, being used for political purposes? And there's a really interesting example you've got in your book about the way that King Richard II in England is treated as the crowned ass. So how does that come about?
Yeah, politically, the ass is a really useful, another one of these useful metaphors. And it's used to criticise political rivals and those in positions of authority. And again, it's this trope of stupidity or the asinine that comes to the fore. So like you said, Richard II, he comes in for quite a bit of censure and he's called this crowned ass. And it's his political rivals that give him this title. I mean, actually, it happens during his successor's reign, so Henry IV, because Henry's supporters attach this crowned ass symbol to Richard because Henry has assumed the throne in dubious circumstances and they want or they need to justify Henry's kingship. So they need to downplay Richard as an effective king. And this crowned ass indicates an ineffective ruler. And obviously Richard's reign was certainly problematic. I mean, not least of all because he came to be king while still a boy. So for Richard's political enemies, it's a really useful tool to apply to Richard. There's another text, a really useful Anglo-Norman text called The Six Kings to Follow John. And Richard's enemies are relying on this because the poem actually assigns animals to all the English kings. And it declares that the fifth king to follow John, which is Richard II, as an ass. And it describes in the poem, the ass king is described as having feet of lead and a head of an ass. So, you know, it's a reference to a slow, ignorant, beastly king. And it works well for Richard's detractors. Interestingly, it's not just Richard's fellow Englishmen who are censoring him. The French use similar ass tropes as well. And maybe that's to be understood because of the rivalry between England and France. But there's a French poet, Eustache Deschamps, who writes a series of poems about the Hundred Years' War. And he's writing in the last sort of quarter of the 14th century. And he likens England and Richard to an ass who was burdensome and who had feet of lead. And Deschamps also declares that the French king, Charles VI, would defeat the ass. So in other words, he would defeat Richard and regain all the French lands that had been lost to Edward III. So this poet is really using political propaganda to encourage Charles to take on the English. And he uses the ass to denigrate Richard and weaken his authority as the King of England. So the message is, Richard is our enemy, but he's slow, he's stupid, and we can defeat him and the English. Which, of course, doesn't happen during Richard's reign, but it does ultimately happen because the French are victorious in the Hundred Years' War. So it's a sort of political prophecy, if you like.
That's fascinating. One other example I was thinking of, I've been doing a little bit of work on the Biotapestry, and there's a notable scene there where one of the main characters in the early stages of the tapestry, Guy of Ponthieu, is shown riding a horse, but with very obvious pointed ass ears. Is that something you looked at in your studies, and would that be making the same point, do you suppose?
I didn't look at this in the course of my studies for the book, and I really wish I had done. So I'm thankful that you've pointed it out. I'd have to have a look at the whole context, you know, the whole image, but it certainly sounds like somebody's having a go at Guy for whatever reason. You know, it could just maybe have been the embroiderer having a bit of fun, but usually this it's deliberate, and there's some message there that's trying to be passed on to the viewer.
Right, getting towards the end here, another sort of metaphor that Asses we used for was as a metaphor for human sexuality. So that's, we haven't really talked about that at all. So tell us how that fits into this story.
Yeah, so I see this as stemming from the encyclopedic and bestiary tradition that depicts the ass as a lustful beast, and that this reputation is then taken up by authors of medieval literature, and it becomes yet another useful trope. I mean, medieval society is interested in human sexuality, and, you know, using it as a way to modify behaviours. So the ass has really got some very distinct sexual tendencies that set it apart from other animals. So, for instance, the fact that the ass could mate with a horse was seen as practicing unnatural sex. And this idea that animals of different species could mate is then used in medieval literature. We've also got the tradition that the ass's loud braying is associated with its lustful urges. I mean, it's false, but it's another way in which medieval authors could use this as a metaphor for human sexuality. One particular example where we see this playing out is in a Spanish reworking of the ass and the lapdog fable. In the original story, the ass is jealous of the lapdog because it gets to sit on its master's lap and be petted, whilst the ass obviously labours away, hard work all day. And then one day the ass decides that it too is going to sit on its master's lap and enjoy a bit of attention. But of course, things don't go well, and the ass ends up getting a beating for its efforts. In the Spanish story, the master is replaced with a mistress. And when the ass tries to sit on the mistress's lap, the result is told in a highly sexualized way. So we're told that the dog licks and kisses with its tongue and mouth, and that it wags its tail and it stands on its hind legs to exhibit its masculinity. And then when the ass mimics the dog's actions, what we read is, I mean, it's all eroticized. The ass enters the mistress's personal space, and it covers the mistress frontally by placing its forelegs on her shoulders. Again, it's all aimed at revealing the ass's sexual prowess. When it stands on its hind legs to embrace the mistress, its phallus is exposed. And then the author describes this whole manoeuvre in terms that's suited more to, you know, a frenzied stallion, if you like. I think the quote is something like a mad fool, or like a mad stud, the fool came on. And then the ass brays, just like the sexually frustrated wild asses who brayed to relieve their sexual tensions. Understanding that, really, projecting these symbols onto the mistress turns this fable from a moral tale that cautions against transgressing against the laws of inherent nature, so an ass can never be a lapdog, it can only ever be an ass. It changes that to a moral tale about the dangers of female sexuality, so the ass's lustful nature is overlaid onto the lustful woman. The ass desired the attention of its mistress, and it actually endangered her, so women's desires to possess men sexually were equally dangerous. That's the message I think it's trying to get across. The tale plays on the medieval belief that women and asses were lustful creatures, and that women could succumb to their animalistic desires.
Right. So that story sort of drops us into an undercurrent of medieval misogyny, then, I suppose, and helps us to understand that, which leads us neatly onto my last wrap-up question, which is, what does study of the ass sort of more broadly tell us about medieval society? What are the themes?
Yes. Well, broadly speaking, I think it tells us that medieval society was interested in animals and their place in the world. It tells us that the ass was an important beast for understanding and attaining salvation, but equally the ass was essential for people's well-being and their livelihoods. You know, most people knew about the ass from this nature or religious perspective, and that its many attributes become useful metaphors for tools and learning. And then, of course, what we see is that those religious and environmental attributes allowed the ass to spread to other areas of medieval culture, and that's why we see this rich presence in literature, in images, even in the hallowed halls of learning. So the ass teaches medieval society about morals, about behaviour, about salvation, and that, I think, really reveals some of medieval society's social, cultural and religious anxieties of the day.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Catherine Smithies. That's an excellent introduction to the topic of the medieval ass, and also into some of these wider themes from medieval society. So a very interesting conversation. And as I said, the book, Introducing the Medieval Ass, that's published now by the University of Wales Press. So if you want to get more on this topic, then have a read of that. And there are some good images of the ass playing the lyre in there and that sort of thing. So it's worth a look. So Catherine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me on your programme. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Catherine Smithies speaking to Dave Musgrove. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear an archive episode on whether the suffragettes were terrorists.